From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, we're going to talk about all things coast to coast. Here's what's happening. A story breaking tonight from the New York Times, the story everybody seems to have been waiting for. American intelligence officials have found no evidence that aerial phenomena witnessed by Navy pilots in recent years are alien spacecraft, but they still say they cannot explain the unusual movements that have mystified scientists and the military, according to senior administration officials briefed on the findings of this highly anticipated government report. The report determines that a vast majority of more than 120 incidents over the past two decades did not originate from any American military or other advanced U.S. government technology. The determination would appear to eliminate the possibility that Navy pilots who reported seeing unexplained aircraft might have encountered programs the government meant to keep secret. But that is about the only conclusive finding in the classified intelligence report. And while a forthcoming unclassified version expected to be released to Congress by June 25th will present few other firm conclusions, senior officials briefed on the intelligence conceded that the very ambiguity of the findings meant the government could not definitively rule out theories that the phenomena observed by military pilots might be alien spacecraft. We have this full story for you in the news at coasttocoastam.com. Go take a look at it. Tomorrow night, Kevin Randall, UFOs in the Deep State, will react to this story. But appears that they are not saying what we wanted them to say. The U.S. Department of Justice is elevating investigations of ransom attacks to a similar priority as terrorism in the wake of the Colonial Pipeline hack and the mounting damage caused by cyber criminals and the hacking into the meat company. Internal guidance sent to U.S. attorney's offices across the country said information about ransomware investigations in the field should be centrally coordinated with a recently created task force in Washington. Now, last month, a cyber criminal group that the U.S. authority said operates from Russia penetrated the pipeline operator on the U.S. East Coast, locking its systems, demanding a ransom. The hack caused a shutdown lasting several days, led to a spike in gas prices, panic buying, and localized fuel shortages in the southeast. And they really hacked into the largest beef producer in Brazil, which affected half of the United States. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has defended Dr. Anthony Fauci as an undeniable asset to the country during the pandemic, after the release of thousands of his emails that provoked renewed Republican accusations that he initially seemed to dismiss the COVID-19 could have originated in a lab. I think there's more to this Fauci story, folks. Now, what's happening to people these days? Listen to this. The youngest attacker who took part in a March carjacking that left an Uber Eats driver dead in Washington, D.C., has pleaded guilty to a murder charge. She's 13 years old. Meanwhile, five unruly flight passengers are facing fines totaling more than $60,000 from the Federal Aviation Administration. People are going crazy on airlines, too. Let's check in with resident psychiatrist Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter, what's going on with these people? What's happening?
Well, I think looking at the passengers is really interesting, George, and we can learn a lot from it. And it's really an interaction. It's not just the flyers, the passengers. It's also the attendants. And from the flyers' viewpoint, you know, there's a terrible fear of losing control. I mean, there's not too many times in life when you're sitting in a situation like that and your life is up to the mechanics of the airplane and the sanity of the pilots. That's very scary for people, especially if you're really big on being in charge, being in control. This anxiety over feeling too cramped, close together. And by the way, at the end, George, I want just a few seconds to tell people about what they can do about this. Then there's a feeling physically trapped, which is different than some of these other feelings. And then being close to a stranger with nothing to say. And, of course, people also drink and take the tranquilizers often, and that, before flying, that can make you irritable. With the masks, it's even worse, of course. That makes you feel paranoid and alienated and resentful. might even make you hypoxic more in the airplane, and there's the fear of catching the COVID. From the flight attendant's viewpoint, almost all these things apply, but there's something special about flight attendants, from my experience, having many of them in therapy when I was in D.C. And it's important to realize that their job is not to have incidents. So when they're faced with an incident, it's a big deal. It's not just an incident like, you know, if you're doing something, selling products in a store. Their job is to keep everybody calm during emergencies, but also during the flight. And then they've got a fear of being reported. And think about if your whole job is to keep people calm, and here you got the whole airplane watching you when you get into a problem. So that's tough. But there is a way out of this for people in terms of handling all this. And that is very simple, but can be a little difficult, which is to engage at least one other person in a caring manner. I used to fly in a lot to Ithaca, and there'd be a young man or woman, maybe hadn't flown much before.
Nervous and scary.
Yeah, and they would be nervous. And I would just pick up a conversation with them and maybe mention, is this your first flight? No, I've had many, or yes, it is. And we would talk, and I would feel better from whatever might have been stressing me, and they would feel better.
Well, I got to tell you, Peter, I've never seen it this bad. Peter's website, Breggin, it's his last name, BREGGIN.com. I sure would like to fly on a plane with you, Peter. You'd be able to calm these people down. High-profile criminal defense attorney F. Lee Bailey, who famously represented O.J. Simpson in his 1995 trial, has died at the age of 87. Bailey served as one of Simpson's attorneys during the former running back's 1995 trial, which ended in his acquittal, the 1994 murders of his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ronald Goldman. U.S. President Joe Biden has offered to scrap his proposed corporate tax hike during negotiations with Republicans, according to two sources familiar with the matter, in what would be a major concession by the president as he works to hammer out an infrastructure deal. The president offered to drop plans to raise corporate tax rates as high as 28% and instead set a minimum of 15% as a tax rate aimed at ensuring all companies pay taxes. Catherine Austin Fitz, our expert on all these matters, is that a 15% fair enough? What do you think, Catherine?
Well, you've got so many corporations doing tax transfer, and the struggle with them is many of them are major corporate government contractors. So if you look at a company like Amazon, they're basically running the databases for the intelligence agencies, the CIA and 17 intelligence agencies, and yet they're able to get away with no taxes. So corporate taxes, the corporate percentage, George, of contribution to taxes has been falling steadily. And so the question is, you know, how do you at least enforce some kind of minimum? The one thing I can't tell is if you look at the descriptions of the infrastructure plan spending, it's very general. So if we've seen a serious deterioration in the quality of financial management over the last 20 years, which is why whenever I look at a story about government money, I just shake my head because it's impossible to tell from these descriptions whether you're going to get a positive return on investment. Right now, the government spending is deeply negative. So, I think it's uncertain. But one thing for sure is that the corporations are not paying their fair share.
Okay, Catherine, always good talking to you. What's new at Solari.com?
Well, we're just about to publish the Going Direct Reset. I think the bigger problem with the finances of the U.S. government is the central banks have too much power. And that's what the Going Direct Reset is about. They're really, they've always controlled monetary policy, but now they're moving to control fiscal policy. And the more the government gets in debt, and the debt right now is skyrocketing, the more power the central banks have.
All right. Thanks, Catherine. Always good talking to you. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu scorned as dangerous and left-wing, a cross-partisan coalition cobbled together by his rivals to unseat him, even as the nationalist named to lead it echoed his hard line on the Palestinians. Netanyahu facing the prospect of an end to his 12-year run as premier of Israel. In a moment, one of the greatest reporters I've ever dealt with. Mark Shaw joins us. His latest work is called Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them Together to Robert Kennedy and the JFK Assassination. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. One of our favorite guests, Mark Shaw, back with us. He's a very prolific investigative reporter and author. A couple of his works include Denial of Justice, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, but his latest work is called Collateral Damage. And the key to this book is the mysterious deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen. She was the reporter and television host. Remember her, those of you who were around then? And the ties that bind them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK assassination. What you're going to hear tonight will be something that you may not have heard over the years with this investigation. And Mark ties things together. I think he's got the solution. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, thank you, George. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my gosh. I got to tell you, I can't stop putting down your books.
Oh, gee.
Even after I've read them, I have to read them again.
You're so kind. It means so much to me. And I might start by saying I never was going to write this new book. I'd written The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice about Dorothy. I'd covered the JFK assassination, the poisoned patriarch. But I want to give you a compliment because it was people around the world, basically, who've read my books, who sent me emails, and some of your listeners, I have a list of them, who said, hey, Mark, there must be a connection between the deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen. There must be. And I said to myself, no, there's not. I don't think there is. But finally, I started looking into it, George. And what I'd like to do tonight, if that's okay, is kind of, I think it's just as important, the conclusions, the facts and conclusions that I come up in the new book with, but how I got there.
Yes, I think that's critical.
You know, in my life, I've kind of always done things ass backwards. And I did here, because normally what you would do investigating here is to investigate Marilyn's death first. That was August of 1962. Then JFK's death in 1963, of course. And then Dorothy's in 1965. But since I had already looked into the JFK assassination, and you know my feelings about that, JFK was killed by Bobby's enemies and all that, then I looked into Dorothy's, death and her, in my opinion, being murdered because she was too close to the truth. By the way, I don't want to forget to tell you that I have been able to, I've received information from a detective at the NYPD Cold Case Squad. Detective Philip Panzarella called me, and they're going to look into Dorothy's death.
I mentioned that last night on the email that you sent us. I think that's dramatic. We'll get into that tonight, too, Mark, because that
anyway,
could be...
I'd like to get into the situation with Marilyn, because there's been so many books written about it, and I thought, look, there's no connection between Marilyn and Dorothy. But when I started out, I started to see that there was, because first of all, Dorothy and Marilyn were very good friends. Marilyn had been to Dorothy's home for parties. I have, primary sources who've told me that. And then more than that, Dorothy had written about Marilyn a great deal. In fact, I think it's the year before, she wrote a column called Marilyn, the Golden Girl, Loses Her Third Marriage, Pursuing Love. And what she did was chronicle her sweetheart marriage first that was divorced, then it was Joe DiMaggio, then it was Arthur Miller, the playwright. And so that got me to thinking, I wonder if she wrote other columns as well. So as we know, Marilyn died in August of 1962. The verdict was, and Dr. Cyril Weck, who you're familiar with,
yes, great
when he
pathologist.
Heard this verdict, and I talked to him about it, the verdict was that she died of a probable suicide.
With her lights on in her bedroom, in the door locked.
And you'll hear Dorothy ask questions about that in a column. But what he told me was he had conducted 16,000 autopsies, and he had never heard of a verdict like that.
Wow.
So that made me, start to think, okay, what did Dorothy write about Marilyn right before she died? And what she wrote was this: Marilyn's health must be improving. She's been attending select Hollywood parties and has become the talk of the town again. In California, they're circulating a photo of her that certainly isn't as bare as the famous calendar, but it's very interesting, and here's the most important part. and she's cooking in the sex appeal department, too. She's proved vastly alluring to a handsome gentleman who is a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio in his heyday.
And everybody knew that was JFK.
Well, they did, but it wasn't.
It was Robert.
It was Robert.
Yep.
And, you know, many people, including me, I didn't remember that Marilyn had an affair with Bobby Kennedy. I always just remember she had one with JFK after she sang happy birthday to him and all that kind of thing.
I had heard, Mark, that after JFK basically passed on her after a while, he kind of handed her to his little brother.
Well, one way or another, Bobby became enamored with her. And so what I want to do next, taking you on this journey, is I had to prove the relationship between Marilyn and RFK, and boy, when I found this particular letter, it just shocked me. It's a letter from Jean Kennedy Smith, who, of course, is President Kennedy's sister, to Marilyn. I understand that you and Bobby are the new item! We all believe you should come with him when he comes back east. So that got me to thinking, hey, Jean Kennedy Smith is okay with Bobby.
Yeah, sounds
Kennedy.
Like she's endorsing the relationship.
It does. And then the next document that I found, and the documents are the most important thing here, because otherwise I'm just saying things, but there's a CIA document that I found that was dated August 3rd, 1962. That's the day before Marilyn died. And here's just part of it, and people can read it in the book. Robert Kennedy has been having a romance and sex affair over a period of time with Marilyn Monroe. He had met her the first day to being arranged by his sister and brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, so on. Robert Kennedy was deeply involved emotionally with Marilyn Monroe and had repeatedly promised to divorce his wife to marry Marilyn. Eventually, Marilyn realized that Bobby had no intention of marrying her, and about that time, and so on and so on and so forth. So that, again, was a clue for me that there was this relationship. And so that made me then wonder, hey, if Dr. Cyril Weck is right, that it wasn't a probable suicide, then, you know, what do I need to look into to find out, you know, exactly how she died? So the next thing I found was the, first of all, the original autopsy report. And here's where, again, you're a curious guy like me, George. I think you would have done the same thing. The original copy of that says acute barbiturate poisoning overdose of drugs.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
So that's on August the 5th, 1962. And then I went to the National Archives and I found a certificate of death, which is just one day later, and at the bottom, signed by Dr. Thomas Noguchi, probable suicide. So something changed there in terms of what happened. And I looked at that like Dorothy did, something is fishy here in terms of how Marilyn died. So then that led me to another column by Dorothy. And it basically was so interesting because after Marilyn died, and that was on August the 4th.
And they were kind of close, weren't they, and Marilyn?
They were. And, you know, Dorothy had a lot of respect for Marilyn. Marilyn had a lot of respect for Dorothy. You know, these were two remarkable women, and I've been Dorothy's voice, and now I'm going to be Marilyn's voice because neither one of them, should have died at an early age. Marilyn at 36, Dorothy at 52. No investigations of their deaths, as we'll get into. But right after Marilyn died, Dorothy wrote this column, and basically it talked about the mail pouring in on the subject of Marilyn Monroe. It's amazing. Many of her fans and people who knew her in life want an investigation above and beyond what the police have conducted. They simply aren't satisfied with a brief autopsy report and so on and so on and so forth. And then, God love her, you know, Dorothy, who's as you know, I believe, has led me from the hereafter on all of my evidence about her and the JFK assassination. She asked all these questions, like, if the woman described as Marilyn's housekeeper is really a housekeeper, why was Marilyn's bedroom such a mess?
Yeah, that's a good point. Hold on for a second, Mark. We're going to hit a break, but we'll come back and talk more about this incredible work, Collateral Damage. Folks, this kicks the lid off of everything you've heard. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back, George Norrie, along with Mark Shaw, his book, Collateral Damage. We are talking about the four incredible people that have had their lives tied in together, JFK, RFK, Marilyn Monroe, and Dorothy Kilgallen. And what we have here is a puzzle. And you can't see the puzzle until you look at all the pieces that are put together. And Mark Shaw has the pieces. And you've been putting them together now, Mark, for how many years?
Well, you know, I started writing books that touched on the assassination about 15 years ago. And it was just amazing, George, how these things happen. Because once I looked into Marilyn's death, then I found new things about Dorothy's death and JFK's and everything. But it was Dorothy who was guiding me. I said that she wrote this column asking all these questions, you know. Why was Marilyn in the nude when she didn't sleep in the nude? Why was the light on? Why was the door locked? Why was the housekeeper doing this and that when the police came? I mean, she asked all these questions, which made me ask questions about it. By the way, you know, RFK, I proved, was in L.A. that summer. He was working on a movie based on his book, The Enemy Within, about the gangsters and everything. So he was there. And I kind of lay out all of this like a prosecutor. So once I knew of Dorothy's questions, then I wanted to know what the mental state was of Marilyn Monroe. And, you know, first of all, I learned a lot about her. I humanize both Marilyn, Dorothy, and JFK in the book because I want people to know what we lost.
She was emotional, right?
When they died.
She was an emotional person.
First, they painted her as a dumb blonde, and she wasn't. There's a book called Fragments that I quote in the book, and it's Marilyn's poetry and writings on stationery and hotels and things like that. It shows a real intellectual side to her.
A deep
side. For
God's
sakes, George, she read Ulysses. I tried to read Ulysses. I couldn't get to the second
page. I haven't even done that yet.
No, and so she wasn't this dumb blonde. She was a smart woman and all of that. And then, you know, I started to look into what was going on in her life. Well, she was having problems with Bobby, as I'll get into just next here. I think this will be fascinating for people, what I found. But everything else was on the upswing. Marilyn wanted to be recognized as a serious actress. She had an offer to do a Broadway play. She was really believing that if she could get over this whole thing with RFK, she might remarry Joe DiMaggio and perhaps have a child, which is the one thing she wanted in life more than anything. So she was on the upswing, and when she died, as you'll hear, they tried to portray her as being suicidal and all of that, but she wasn't. So I found that information, and then I came across what I really believe is what you would call, I guess, the smoking gun in a case like this. It was this same CIA document, 3 August 1962, and it was based on a wiretap that, for whatever reason, was put on Dorothy Kilgallen's telephone, and it recorded conversations between Marilyn and Dorothy and a gentleman who was kind of a go-between with them, a friend of Dorothy's. And it talks about, first of all, listen to this, George, all three of our subjects in this book, fascination with UFOs.
I know,
Marilyn,
I saw that in one of your books.
Fascinated, yeah. And JFK was as well. So there was a connection between the three of them that I had never known about. And it's interesting because I think I talked to you before that Dorothy had actually gone to England to an UFO convention at one point.
Yeah, she was into this in a big way.
She really was, and so I confirmed all that. But listen just exactly to what the bottom part of this CIA document says. Subject, and that's Marilyn, repeatedly called the Attorney General in June of 62 and complained about the way she was being ignored by the president and his brother. The subject, Marilyn, has threatened to hold a press conference and tell all about the relationships. Subject has made references to bases in Cuba and knew of the president's plan to kill Castro.
This would have destroyed his reelection campaign in 64.
And Bobby's career as well.
Yep.
And so I was able then to find eyewitnesses who were around Marilyn the week before she died. She was at a hotel up on the Nevada-California border, and apparently Marilyn was lured up there. There were some negotiations going on where they might film her with one of the Kennedys and use that against her or whatever that way. And when she found out what was going on, She said that basically she continued to feel like, and I quote her, "I feel like a piece of meat being thrown around by the Kennedys." So she screamed and yelled. She tried to find DiMaggio to take her back to L.A., but when she got there, she basically said, "I'm going to go to the press with all of this." Well, you can imagine, you know, Bobby Kennedy was known as kind of the vacuum cleaner for the Kennedy family. He you know, picked up all the bad things that happened with JFK and everything, but now he's in trouble.
And they were petrified of Father Joe, and I'm sure he hadn't been told about this yet.
Oh, not at all, no. And so, you know, what does Bobby do? So I thought to myself, all right, if I've shown that it's unlikely that she committed suicide, she was in a good mental state and all of that, who's the most logical person to have had motive to done something to Marilyn? And I came across an amazing book. Now, you know me, I really look at primary sources. I did not use any books or articles past 1965. Now, so many other authors have done that through the years and use other information. But I came across a book called The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe. And it was written by a controversial author. It was only 70 pages. But you'll see that it absolutely drove the Kennedy people nuts. Just to read one article, one piece from there, he wrote, "The ruthlessness of this man, Bobby Kennedy, his utter disregard for the rights of others, is frightening. He does not hesitate to try to embarrass and even disgrace the president of the United States so that he can promote himself. All he wants is to be president himself." And then a couple of pages later, he talks about how Marilyn and RFK, you know, met and goes into the fact that, you know, RFK was really, you know, petrified, as you used the word, that she might go to the press with all of this, not only, George, with the facts of the sexual relationships with JFK and RFK, but all of these matters of national security. Obviously, pillow talk or whatever else it was, but they confided in her. And so you've got Marilyn on the cusp of going ahead and alerting the media to all the things that are going on. Well, who's the guy who has the motive to have decided to silence her?
Yeah,
well,
who,
the problem I had
who benefits?
With this,
who benefits?
Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah.
The problem I had with that is that Bobby Kennedy, he didn't have to be in L.A. to have orchestrated her death, but he had this seemingly airtight alibi of being in San Francisco. Well, I have destroyed that alibi. Because basically I was able to find that on the day Marilyn died, the 20th Century Fox Studios had a ledger. And it basically said, let me see if I can find it, but I can paraphrase it, that, before 11 a.m. on August 4th, 1962.
That's the date she died.
That's the day she died. A helicopter landed in the 20th Century Fox Studios helipad near Stage 14. Studio publicist Frank Neal, working that Saturday morning, said he saw Robert Kennedy jump out of a helicopter and rush to a dark gray limousine waiting nearby. Neal said he got a glimpse of movie star Peter Lawford, brother-in-law to the Kennedys, sitting beside him. So obviously he was there, and then I found an account from a Beverly Hills police officer who stopped Peter Lawford's car at midnight, just after Marilyn would have died. He looked in the car. He knew Peter Lawford, this police officer, Lynn Sherman, knew Peter Lawford, who was driving. He looked in the back seat. There was Bobby Kennedy. And guess who was sitting in the front seat with Peter Lawford? Marilyn Monroe's psychiatrist, Greenson.
Oh, my God.
And so even Daryl...
And he's the one they called when she died.
Right, exactly.
And he waited like an hour or two before he called police, didn't he?
That was really... You know, there's so many apparent problems with this whole situation, but just like in Dorothy's death with the stage death scene, nobody did that. Then I found this article, and I've just got to tell you about it. Again, it was in a photo play magazine in August 1963, and I just happened onto it. I think Dorothy kind of helped me find it and everything. Written by a European journalist, Martha Donaldson, who knew a lot of Marilyn's friends. And she wrote a book, 1 year later, Marilyn Monroe's Killer Still at Large. You can see him in a crowd. You can reach out and touch him because he is a great man, famous, known all over the world. And maybe he that touch will give you at least a small part of him. You can see him on television. You will look at him and think how lucky his wife is to be married to him, and how lucky his children are, his many children are, to have him for a father. And maybe you think, I wish I were his wife. You can read about him almost every day in the newspapers and magazines, and you will think, this is a good person. This is a truly honorable man. But what you will never, ever read, never know, is that this man is a killer. He is the man who killed Marilyn Monroe.
Wow. Did it get much play or coverage?
It got none.
Nothing.
It got none.
And here's the big thing that I've found in reading Collateral Damage. All of the people we are talking about, the four players in this unbelievable story, all died within 5 or 6 years of each other. What are the odds of that happening? Marilyn Monroe, 62, JFK, 63, Kilgallen, 65, RFK, 68. What are the odds of four people intricately involved with each other all dying within that period? It's bizarre.
My wife would tell you that when I realized that, I screamed at my writing table. I had never thought about that. Within 40 months, you got Marilyn, JFK, and Dorothy, and then Bobby just a few years later. I mean, I don't know what the odds would be. And yet they were all connected there some way or another, as we know, because the three, Marilyn, Dorothy, and JFK, were connected for sure, and then Bobby was right in the middle of all of that. And, you know, I just want to mention then that I came across a couple FBI files that just made me realize that I was on the right track with naming Bobby Kennedy as the one most likely to have orchestrated Marilyn's death. And in the book, I show how that would happen.
Do you think Hoover knew anything about this because he hated Bobby Kennedy, who was his boss?
Well, could have, but it didn't. It's not anything that I could document. But I think it could have happened. But there's a July 8th, 1964. Attorney, this is an FBI memo to Bobby Kennedy, okay? And it talks about this book by Frank Capel, and he says, according to Mr. Capel, his book will make reference to your alleged friendship and love affair with the late Marilyn Monroe. Mr. Capel stated that he will indicate in his book that you and Monroe were intimate and that you were in Marilyn Monroe's apartment, her home, at the time of her death.
Oh, my gosh.
Sent to Bobby Kennedy.
Oh, my gosh.
Then 1 week later, there's another memo, and it's all about they were scared to death of this book that Frank Capel was sending out, this strange death of Marilyn Monroe. And so these FBI agents discuss it in here. And they say, the author suggests Miss Monroe was led to believe Bobby Kennedy's intentions were serious and that Kennedy had promised to divorce his wife and marry her. When he failed to do so, the book charges, she threatened to expose their relationships. It was then that Bobby Kennedy decided to take drastic action.
Now, what do the Kennedy family say about these allegations? Have they approached you?
You're just going to be amazed at that. No, not at all yet. And they may or they may not. But let me just give you one piece of, you know, Dorothy always looked for the little clues, George. That was why she was so good with figuring out what happened.
Oh, she was an excellent reporter.
Just listen to this. I found this in another FBI memo that nobody, I think, had ever tried to look at. And basically what it said was that the FBI, and this is where Hoover may have become involved, the FBI was ordered to go out and buy as many books, Frank Capel books, as they could, and the Kennedys would try to buy the rest of them.
Oh my God.
So nobody could read them.
Get them off the shelves.
They
didn't have Amazon in those days, Mark. Mark, we're going to hit a break. We're going to come up after the top of the hour. Let's circle back to Marilyn, but let's get into JFK. I've got some questions to ask you about that. I think you have solved that unbelievable assassination crime. We'll get into that and much more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.